Today on Maine Calling, checking in with our automotive gurus. When's the last time you shopped for a new car? A year ago? During the pandemic? Well, it's different now. The automotive landscape is shifting. The average price of a new car has dropped a little since last year. There is more inventory at auto dealers, and there are more small cars to choose from. However, the used car market is a different story. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk about the trends in the automotive industry with our favorite car gurus, John Paul of AAA and Jamie Page Deaton of Car Talk. Up for discussion, the state of the electric vehicle market, important safety recalls, and answers to your automotive questions. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downey's communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Apparently, Americans are buying more small cars again. That's one of the topics we're going to cover today, along with recent recalls from a whole host of manufacturers and the state of the EV market. Joining me to talk about auto-related news and to answer your car questions, John Paul, Senior Manager of Public Affairs and Traffic Safety with AAA Northeast, and Jamie Page Deaton, Editor-in-Chief at CarTalk.com. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'll say it again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you, and happy summer. John, I'll start with you. What have you been driving lately, and have you liked it?
It's pretty hard not to like new cars these days. They're all pretty good, really. One of the ones I just drove recently was the Volvo S60 plug-in hybrid. And it had it claimed to have a 40-mile electric range. When I charged it up, it was actually closer to 50 miles. I drove it quite a bit on just pure electric. I was able to plug it into just 110-volt outlet when the battery is completely depleted. It did take overnight to recharge it, but it's certainly a vehicle that could kind of bridge that gap between somebody who wants to go electric and they're not quite sure yet. It's also kind of a sports sedan, too. It developed over 400 horsepower, 0 to 60 in, I don't know, stupid time, 4.5 seconds or something. It was fast enough, it handled enough, and it had certainly one of the most frustrating and aggravating infotainment systems that I've ever seen in a car. It just always wanted to default back to the home screen. It would shut the radio off when you had it on the day before. It was just everything about the infotainment system seemed like they tried to cram a whole bunch of stuff into some dated technology, and it just didn't seem to work very well. It did have built-in Google Maps, which I liked, but overall, I mean, the ride was good, the performance was good, and the idea that you could go claimed when it had a fully charged battery and a full tank of fuel, somewhere around a 700-mile range. And the seats were comfortable, but I don't know if any seat's that comfortable to stay in for 700 miles. But but it certainly would be a great long-range cruiser. It would be a great short commuter car if you just didn't want to go to the gas station. Just worked out. It was a vehicle that worked out, I think, really well. The one I drove was what was called the Black Edition, which interestingly only comes in black and white. But it was a great car, but not cheap either. So
yeah, I was going to ask.
What is it listed for? You're going to be up around the $70,000 range.
Yeah, and John, I read something recently that the list price is really something no consumer pays, that most consumers pay 20 or 30% more.
That's starting to change. We're seeing a lot more car sales that are much closer to manufacturers' suggested retail. And part of that was all from a combination of COVID, supply chain issues. There's still supply chain issues. There's still people waiting for a long time, waiting for parts. And you know, it's weird stuff you don't think of. It's the chemicals that go into making aluminum are all of a sudden in short supply and they can't get them. And so all of these things kind of caused some of that. It was a big surprise when COVID happened. Everybody went out and bought a car. And, you know, that caused the used car market to go crazy. It caused the new car market to be a little bit weird as well. You know, from what all the people who monitor all those pricing tell me, we're starting to see right now where you can start to, you know, and we never paid MSRP before. We always paid, you know, 10% less or 20% less. At least now we're starting to see sales at MSRP. So it's starting to turn around a little bit.
All right, Jamie, what vehicles, what new cars are you excited about right now?
Yeah, I've got to say, I'm so jealous of John because I wanted to buy that car back in 2021 and there were only three left in the country and I could not get my hands on one. So super happy that John got to try it out because it's just such a fun, fast wagon. I was visualizing myself, you know, with kids and dogs in the back, just absolutely tearing up the road and, you know, beating all of these Mustangs out of stoplights and things like that. But since I couldn't get one, other cars that I'm really excited about are there are a bunch of really good EVs coming on the market. One of the ones that I'm really excited about, honestly, is the Chevy Equinox EV. And the Equinox is a great, you know, small to mid-size SUV, depending on your categorization. It's going to have a 250 to 300 mile range. I say only kind of lightly, but this is just the reality of, you know, new car prices. It's going to start at $30,000, which I realize is still a lot of money, but in the realm of new cars, it's actually not the way that prices have gone. I'm also really excited about the new Mini Cooper and Mini Countryman. The Mini Cooper is going to start, and this is the EV, is going to start at about $32,000, which is a really good price for an EV. And so if you're able to potentially stack some tax credits on top of that, you can get something that's just really fun to drive. I mean, I love the current Mini Cooper EV. It's one of my all-time favorite cars that I've ever driven. And so to see it get a little bit of a refresh, that's just going to mean, you know, I think it's just going to be great if you're in the market for a small EV. And what really has me excited about it, though, is the battery technology allows it to go from 10% charge to 80% charge in less than 30 minutes, depending on the type of charging system that you use. So if you're able to find a fast charger, or if you know, then you're going to be able to get the car charged up almost all the way in the time it would take you to maybe get a cup of coffee, read the newspaper, you know, take a break from the road, or you know, maybe you're inside getting groceries or something like that. So those are two that I'm really excited about. I will admit, Equinox, not that exciting of a car. It's not flashy. But if you're looking for an EV that can handle, you know, daily commuting, family duty, it's hard to go wrong with that one.
All right. And, you know, you're talking about the Mini Coopers. I wanted to talk about the supposed renaissance of small cars. And I'm going to go to an email that's already come in from Greg. Greg writes, every year, American auto manufacturers have been enticing the public to buy heavier, larger, ever more powerful Leviathans. Now, after killing off their small cars and sedans in 2019, Ford CEO Jim Farley is extolling their virtues and calling on Americans to fall back in love with smaller vehicles. Can we expect to hear a rebirth of the VW Beetle slogan, think small, or is something else at work? And then he adds, fun fact, last year the average vehicle sold in the U.S. weighed 4,329 pounds, an increase of 1,000 pounds compared to 1980, which is really astonishing to me because I remember cars in 1980 and they were like, you know, yachts, so land yachts. So that's really interesting. But John, let's talk about this. This is the news in the automotive world right now, the automotive press, all the small cars that are coming out. Is it because the consumer wants to buy small cars? What's going on?
Well, some of it, I think, has to do with CAFE standards. You know, there's very strict CAFE standards on the horizon between EVs and fuel economy. I think small cars are what's going to make it happen. Also, people buy what they like, and that's kind of the reason why big SUVs are out there. But on the other hand, like the emailer pointed out, there's a little bit of lack of choice. GM just announced they're going to do a couple of small pickup trucks, kind of competitive with the Maverick. So whether we see small sedans or small trucks, I think we are going to see more of them. I just recently was driving the Mazda 3, and it happened. It's had kind of the turbocharged version, but it's a small car. It's fun to drive. It has enough room in it. I went and picked up a small bureau the other day and squished it in the back. It's a hatchback, and it worked out fine. I think we're going to see, whether we see more of this. I don't know. I'm literally staring across the window out the window right now, and there's a new Ford Bronco in one side of the driveway, and I think the other person is driving a Honda Pilot. So, are they going to all of a sudden suddenly go to, Japanese K cars? Probably not, but maybe something a little bit bigger than that.
Jamie, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I have a, I think there's two things going on here. One is the smaller the car, generally the less expensive it is. And today's small cars are nothing like kind of the Japanese K cars of the early 80s. They're good quality, and they're actually what we consider a small car is much bigger than what we used to consider. They have much roomier interiors. As John was pointing out, with the Mazda 3, yes, it's a small hatchback, but you can fit a dresser in there. You can take it to Home Depot. You can take it to Costco. You can take it on a road trip. So one, I think there is, a better product that's being offered by a lot of car makers. But two, they're less expensive. Interest rates are high. Wages have not kept up with inflation. We're seeing the price of, new cars go up all the time. And so I think some consumers are realizing, I don't have to be in a ginormous car. And that helps them save on, not just the car, but also the price of insurance, the price of gas, if that goes up as, it seems to be doing. Beyond that, too, it's important to delve into the data a little bit because it's not really small cars that are driving this growth. It's compact and subcompact SUVs. So people are still wanting to sit a little bit up high. They still want some space, but they're able to get it in a smaller package than they have been in the past. And honestly, too, not only are these cars, better, they drive better, but they also have a lot of the same features that you can get in a larger car. I mean, they still have, great infotainment systems. They still have, accident avoidance systems. They still have, a lot of the things that you would assume only go into higher price models, they've trickled down into the small cars. And then my other theory, and this has, I haven't gotten exact data for this, but we're starting to see, younger millennials and Gen Z enter the new car buying market. And, if there's anything that we've kind of seen is these groups, they like to do kind of the opposite of what their parents did. So whereas, some younger boomers, older Gen X were all about like getting the big minivan and driving the big family SUV, whereas, their parents were driving large sedans. Now there's a little bit of, I think, a little bit of a generational revolt where it's, I don't want to drive something that's big. I realize I can fit my family into something smaller. So I want to do something different. And I don't want to drive something that's, going to feel like my mom's car or anything like that. So I think there's a little bit of generational shift in consumer taste driven in part by, cost and the increasing quality of those cars. So it's really interesting to see. I think that some of these US automakers that had really abandoned the small car market, it'll be interesting to see if they can make up for it with the small trucks and with the smaller SUVs and crossovers.
It's interesting, Jamie, because I've always liked small cars and I've always thought, am I not a typical American? They're easier to parallel park. I feel like I have more control on the highway. There are a whole lot of reasons I like a smaller car. But I'm wondering also if part of it is because not just the Gen Zs, but baby boomers don't have children anymore. They're not schlepping around a carpool. And why do you need, and maybe they're doing things like, going to the theater or going on a quick road trip and they don't want to be spending a lot of money on gas.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if you have a large SUV, they're difficult to climb into. A big truck is hard to climb into. My husband drives a Land Rover Defender, and every time I have to get into it, I have to use the grab handles because I'm quite short. Whereas, if you have mobility issues, getting into a subcompact SUV like a Honda HR-V or a Chevy Trax, It's really easy. Those seats are at hip height. So if you are aging and experience kind of mobility issues like a lot of boomers are facing, these cars make a lot of sense for them as well. I haven't seen, this data broken down kind of by generation, but it'll be interesting. I think in the next couple of months and years, we'll start to see, whether it is a generational divide driving some of these changes. But I'm with you, Jennifer. I love a small car. That said, when you're on the highway and you're surrounded by, monster trucks and SUVs, it can be a little bit intimidating, when you can't see very well around these things in front of you. But just overall, there's, small cars have a ton to offer. And, as Americans, like we don't need to be driving these behemoths, but for whatever reason, for the past 20 or so years, we've fallen in love with them. And so it's interesting to see, like, will this love affair end, or, and we'll shift to small cars, or is this just a blip, and we'll continue going for the big boys?
John.
Jamie brought up a really good point about small cars and the attention to detail and the technology that's in them. I remember when I think it was some model of Mazda in their equivalent of a Mazda 3 or Mazda 2 put Bluetooth in it. And that was like, oh, that was a big deal. That was, you don't see that in, entry level cars. And the idea that you can go out and buy a car that is more reasonably priced with all the technology in it, including all the crash avoidance technology, I think is really important. And I think the average transaction price for a new car now is around 48,000, and the average EV price is around 55,000. So the idea that you can maybe buy something that's solid with all the comfort features you want in it and all the safety features, and still do well in crash testing for maybe $25,000 or $30,000, and have something that's nimble and easy to park. I'm a pretty big guy, but I happen to like small cars. I've always been a fan of small cars. So, SUVs are nice. They're nice for bad weather. They're nice for trips to the home improvement store. But, a lot of times today, you can manage with a small car and manage really well.
We'll go to Raquel, who's calling from Swanville. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, last year I went to look at some new vehicles, which I ended up buying one. And the dealership had an electric vehicle of the version of the Mitsubishi Outlander that I did buy. And when I was talking to him, he brought up a good point as far as the warranty on the electric vehicles. He said that most of the electric vehicles, because of the batteries, that the warranty does not cover the batteries. And he also said that some of the vehicles, the batteries are as expensive as the vehicles themselves. So I'm just wondering, as far as, does that vary depending on the manufacturer or the warranties? Because I know warranties are important, especially when you buy a new vehicle and, something happens, it can be very expensive. So I'll be honest with you, that's really what deterred me from even considering an electric vehicle, and the fact that, there's not a lot of charging portals in Maine as well. So I was wondering if you could give me some more information about that.
Raquel, thanks for your question. Who wants to take this, John?
Sure. No, the batteries are one of the highest warranty features inside the vehicle. So, sometimes they're 10 years, 100,000 miles, 8 years, or 100,000 miles. It's part of the emissions package. So, the battery's kind of the more stable part of the vehicle. And maybe the idea that Mitsubishi has a 10-year, 100,000 mile drivetrain warranty, it makes the battery warranty not look so spectacular. But on the other hand, if you went and bought a Chevy Bolt, it has a pretty good battery warranty. So, so I'm not quite sure what that was about. But I mean, I'm not a big leasing fan, but when it comes to electric vehicles, I sort of lean towards leasing because of the technology that's changing, and will that vehicle be worth what it should be worth in 3 or 4 years? When you have a lease, even though I don't generally like leases because it just locks you into monthly payments all the time, but I think leasing an electric car, especially in the time we're in right now and the amount of electric cars are changing, kind of makes some sense.
Jamie.
Yeah, I think John makes a really, really good point. I don't know the battery warranty on the Outlander EV, but typically the warranties on the batteries and the electric components run longer than the other warranties. But John's point about leasing is really, really smart. So when I mentioned earlier that I was looking at the Volvo V60 Polestar, I was going to lease that car, not only because it was, $70,000 and a lease helps you not pay for that full amount, but because I didn't know what the technology would be when the lease was over. And so, like, if you're thinking about an EV or a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, that's something to really consider is the lease. Because what can happen is you can, make those monthly payments, and then at the end of the lease, you can decide if you want to buy that car or if you want to turn it in for something where maybe the technology has leapfrogged ahead. And if you purchase that car, you're locked in. And as the technology jumps ahead, a car is always a depreciating asset, but you're really locked in to a depreciating asset. Now, like John mentioned, from a personal finance perspective, leases are a terrible idea. You're never going to pay it off, and you're going to have monthly payments forever. Whereas what you usually want to do is make as big a down payment as you can afford, pay off the car, and then drive it into the ground, when you don't have payments. But when we're in this moment where the technology is changing so much, I'd strongly consider a lease. The other benefit, if like Raquel, you're concerned about the warranties, that warranty is going to run the length of the lease. And so that's not going to be a real concern of yours. And so if that's something that, is maybe holding you up from considering an EV or a plug-in hybrid, I would definitely put leasing on the table and, run the numbers and see if it works for you.
Well, we do need to take a break. We're talking about cars, trucks, and SUVs. We have our experts here to answer your questions. The phones are filling up. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, the latest from the world of cars, trucks, and SUVs, and answers to your automotive questions. My guests, Jamie Page Deaton from CarTalk.com and John Paul from AAA Northeast. Share your comments and questions by email, a brief email, please, talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Dr. Richard Corey, who is director and co-founder of the VEMI Lab at the University of Maine. Rick, thanks so much for joining us. Explain what the VEMI Lab does.
Oh, thanks for having me. The VEMI Lab, we study the way humans interact with technology, and specific to this call, in the last 6 years, we've been studying the way humans are going to be interacting with fully autonomous vehicles in the future. And we do this in all kinds of different ways, but we can get into that later.
So that's so interesting because I know a couple of years ago we were, or maybe more like 5 years ago, there was a lot of discussion about autonomous cars, and they were, going to be here before we knew it, and they were going to be everywhere. And I'm wondering what your take is on where we are in this journey towards autonomous cars. Is it happening a little more slowly than we expected a few years ago?
Oh gosh, yes. It's far slower than we ever expected it. I think the companies were really inflating their numbers. I mean, the last number we had heard was 2021, everything would be, up and running. And I don't have one yet, so I don't know about anyone else. I think what's happening is the slow growth is basically because the sudden realization of it moving to more of a service industry rather than, the manufacturing tools that, cars are essentially a simplified tool. So now that we've moved to more of a service and realizing that more humans are going to have to deal with these, and especially when you get to this, what they call level 5 autonomy, and that's, there's no steering wheel, there's no input at all from the human, it gets a lot trickier.
Interesting. So it's the whole system that will change. I know that you've been working on how to make autonomous cars more accessible to users. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, we're trying to. Well, if you think about today, there's a whole group of people that can't drive. Well, and that could be folks that are blind or visually impaired. That could be people that are older, having some sort of cognitive impairment. And that's also, anyone under the age of 16. So for us, one of the areas we study is how do we make these inclusive for everybody to use? And we've been working on this for about 6 years in different grants and stuff. And we have a fully autonomous vehicle simulator here, and where we can actually put six or seven people in the vehicle and see what their needs are. And the idea here is that how can we make this safe for everyone? How can we make the communication that happens between the car, which essentially is an AI, and the people within it, how can we make that happen no matter where you are or what age you are or what you're looking for, and understand that level of communication, understanding like things that are most people don't really think about, like geographic vernacular, where, you know, we refer to it as soda here, it's pop in other places and things like that. And how do those simple things get adjusted with the humans in the car? Because this is going to be, you know, a service world, and where you actually have people, you know, talking directly to the vehicle and trying to get what you need.
And you think Maine is the ideal place to study autonomous vehicles. Why is that?
Well, we have a few things that make this very unique here in the state. Number one, we have one of the oldest populations by age mean across the board. Number two, we have a lot of tertiary roads, and some are not painted, and anybody who lives here in the States knows what I'm talking about, and that are set up in a way in which testing a vehicle, if a vehicle is, say, following a line, it gets a little trickier up here. And the third is we have a very diverse four-season weather conditions. So if you think about this in terms of we have snow, we've got black ice, but we also have these little things called autumn where these leaves come down that are multicolored that sit on a road and can really throw off a computer vision system and sometimes have a hard time where it sees actually where the road is versus a line. So it's a great test bed. This isn't LA where everything's nice and flat, or Arizona where everything kind of stays the same way. We have potholes, we have other issues out there, and it's a great place if you really want to test and get this to work in a rural area.
Oh, I love it. We do have potholes, that's for sure. John,
yeah,
with John with AAA has a question for you. Go ahead, John.
I had a quick question. I mean, we talk about human interface with autonomous vehicles.
Yep.
If the autonomous vehicles are on the road, is there going to be autonomous car bullying? Where, oh, I know that's an autonomous car, so I'm going to pull out in front of it because I know it's going to stop?
I think there might be that type of thing go on out there. I mean, we kind of know that the transition before we get to this world of full autonomy, where basically, and this is, you know, horrible, but when the manual cars are off the road and you're only allowed with a fully autonomous, I think in that transition period, I think you can probably see something like that happen, especially people who can identify this is a fully autonomous car and maybe I can mess with it a little bit. But considering the people that we have spoken to, these huge underrepresented groups, a lot of people are just so excited that this is a possibility that they can get access to transportation they haven't had before. On average in the state of Maine, I think we're like 20 minutes from a grocery store. So, you know, when you get old enough or you're having some sort of physical mobility problems and you still need to be able to get there, this might be a better way. But, yeah, I hope the bullying doesn't happen, but it could. We've seen some weirder stuff out there.
Rick,
do you
thank
envision
you so much.
The future?
Oh,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead, John. Go ahead, John.
Do you envision the future is more car sharing with autonomous vehicles, or will people actually own them?
No, it's definitely going to be car sharing. Is when all the insurance and all the rights and the safety fall back onto the automotive industry, I highly doubt. In all the industry contacts we're working with right now, no one is really speaking about owning. And I'm not saying that it won't be a rare occasion out there. But just like Netflix and everything, you're definitely going to have, you know, your subscription service to whatever car company you want or multiple car companies, depending on where you're going. And that is definitely the direction we're moving forward, especially with autonomous vehicles.
Rick, thank you so much for calling in. You know, whenever we do a Maine Calling program on transportation, so many people in rural Maine call and feel trapped because of their age, or as you said, because of their eyesight or something. And so I can really envision how you all are thinking about the future. And thank you so much. Rick Corey is calling from UMaine, their VEMI lab. We will move on to Penelope from Levant. Hi, Penelope. Go ahead.
Hi. I am... thinking of purchasing a brand new Toyota Tacoma standard shift pickup truck next year. As a woman, I have great anxiety walking onto the dealership because I'm at a distinct advantage. So I bring a man with me, and without fail, the car dealer salesman will walk up to the man and address him first, which not only infuriates me, but it just reinforces the bad reputation that car dealers have with me as a woman. I would like advice on how to maneuver through the whole sales process because I am not automotive literate. And I think AAA should publish a car buyer's guide exclusively for women. I need advice to maneuver through the whole experience.
Well, Penelope, I'm going to actually go to Jamie because Jamie is a woman, and as she has said many times on the show, not a particularly tall woman, but you are an expert. So, Jamie, what is the attitude and how do you enter a dealership? How do you talk to the, what kind of advice would you give Penelope about how to talk with salespeople?
Yeah, Penelope, you are not alone in this frustration. You know, I'm an expert. I've worked in this industry for over 15 years. I have served on the jury for North American Car, Truck, and Utility of the Year, and invariably, the dealers talk to my husband. And now he does know about cars, but he doesn't know as much about them as I do. And he also doesn't, you know, kind of manage the family finances. I do. And so, you know, figuratively and sometimes literally, when we go to buy a car, I'm in the driver's seat. And it is incredibly frustrating to have the dealer keep talking to him. And if there are any dealers listening, any salespeople listening, you're effectively turning off 50% of your potential customers. And women make the majority of car purchases in the United States. And women are getting ahead of men in terms of education, and they're catching up in terms of income. So if you're a salesperson or a dealership and you're not treating women well, best of luck to you. Because the other thing is, and Penelope, when you've had this bad experience, and I'm going to talk about how to avoid it here in a second, but if you have a bad experience, write a negative Google review. Get on social media, put that dealership on blast, use names, use details, because that's one of the weapons that we do have to get dealers to behave better, is letting them know that this type of behavior is unacceptable. But I mean, the best thing is to avoid it in the first place. And I know it can be difficult, particularly, you know, if, you know, I've found that, you know, automotive, it's a male dominated industry. So I'm fairly comfortable going into a room full of men and, you know, holding my own. But if you're not used to that, if you haven't worked in a male dominated industry, then it can be very difficult. And I really want to, you know, sympathize both, you know, with Penelope and anybody who's been in that situation. So there are a couple of things that you can do in order to make the experience a lot better. And this is always what I do as well. First, and I started doing this, you know, when I was getting started buying cars, is just practice, practice, practice. And I know it sounds so counterintuitive and frankly frustrating that you should have to practice talking to someone before you go and give them a lot of money. But ultimately, if you're lacking the confidence and you're feeling like you're going to be on the back foot, practice, number one, all the time. So if you can find particularly a male friend or a relative who is able to kind of go through and be, you know, kind of a guy's guy and take on that role and talk through with you, go for it. Practice that. The next thing is do your research. Penelope, you said you're not a car person, but you're buying a Toyota Tacoma with a standard shift. Guess what? You are a car person. That's a great model. You've done your research. You're buying a great truck, but read everything that you need to know about that truck and do not trust the dealers to answer your questions. Because oftentimes, you know, if you're a car salesman, you're going to have 20 or 30 models on the lot. They're not going to know everything about them. And so, some, you know, it's been my experience that you often get incorrect information there. So make sure that you have all the questions that you, you know, would want to have answered. Get them answered before you go to the dealership. Hop online, watch videos, read reviews. That's really going to help. So when the, you know, if the dealer says something, you're going to be able to say, actually, you know, Car and Driver said this is true, or actually Consumer Reports said this. Now, where a lot of the times I think it becomes really difficult is when you get into the negotiation phase. And so the main thing here is to treat it like a business transaction, because that's absolutely what it is. And so first, I would go in pre-approved for a loan, work with your bank or your credit union and have that loan. And so that basically will let you say to the car dealer, hey, I've got this loan. It's at 7%. If you can beat it, I'll work with you. But if not, I'm just going to go with this loan. And that immediately just puts it out in plain black and white, kind of takes gender out of it. This is what you need to do to earn my business. Also, you can go now and check. And, you know, if you use Car Gurus, there are so many different services where you can go in and get a, you know, a price quote ahead of time. So one of the things that I like to do, and this is probably, well, I have a little bit of an advantage because my name is Jamie and you can't always tell my gender from email. But start the negotiation process over email. Contact a bunch of different, you know, dealers in your area and say, hey, I'm looking for the best price. And then you can respond in your own time. So you can read an email and say, okay, this guy, he's offering me this at this price. But over here at this other dealership, they're offering me that at another price. And so then you can just simply respond to the email and it takes gender out of the equation, or in a large part out of the equation. And it lets you kind of finalize the deal before you even go into the dealership. You can have it in writing and make sure you print out those emails and bring them with you and say, hey, you know, I was working with Doug. This is the offer he made. This is what I'm here to do today. And that will help quite a bit as well. And then the other thing, and this is difficult. It takes a lot of practice, but that's why I also kind of recommend role-playing at the beginning. Be flat out and say, why are you talking to him? I'm the one making the purchase. Like, that's just a fair question to ask. I think a lot of times as women, we're conditioned not to ask those types of questions, but it is absolutely a fair question. Why are you talking to him? I'm making the purchase. This isn't his car. He's just here for company. Talk to me. I'm making the purchase. But ultimately, I think this is a great message for car dealers that you have to do better. And one other thing that did just occur to me, I will say the absolute best experience that I've ever had buying a car was when I bought it from a woman who was a salesperson. So if you can go and find, you know, a woman who's a salesperson at a Toyota dealership, they're few and they're far between, but they're there. And they make it so much easier because it feels a little just bit more comfortable. But otherwise, you know, practice, do as much over email, get as much pre-approval as you can. And then, you know, if you're not getting the service you want, remember, it's a business transaction. They should be working to get your business. And so, hey, why are you talking to him? I'm making the purchase. He doesn't have a say. Or, hey, you know what? I really feel like you're talking down to me. I'm not enjoying this experience. I'm not feeling like you're worth my business. I'm going to go elsewhere. That's ultimately what we have to do to kind of retrain a lot of people, because it is, you know, it's a big cultural shift within the car industry. But ultimately, you know, Penelope, I have no doubt, because you've had the forethought to A, pick this car out a year in advance, and B, call in here for advice. So I think that you're going to do great. Just prepare before you go in and remember, they are there to get your business and it is a business transaction. And so should be no hard feelings about you walking away. It's just business.
Penelope, thank you for your call. And we do need to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about cars. My guests, AAA's John Paul and CarTalk.com's Jamie Page Deaton. You can try to get through. We have so many emails and calls. I'm not sure you will, but you can call 1-800-399-3566 or try to squeeze in an email at talk@mainpublic.org. I'm going to read two emails that are about Tesla. The first from Pat. I have EV charging station anxiety. I was excited when a bank of charging stations was installed in Rockland, but they only work on Teslas. I thought Tesla was obligated to have universal connectors. Do you know if that's going to happen? FYI, I have a Prius Prime plug-in hybrid with 40-mile range. I want to use as little gasoline as possible, but except for short commutes, my car has to transition to gas. And then from Ned, we've had a Tesla model for 3 to 4 years. Love the car. Fun to drive. Almost no maintenance costs. And the Tesla's supercharger network ensures we never worry about running out of charge and recharging as fast. We would like to divorce ourselves from Elon Musk, the Elon Musk world, but are concerned that charging other EVs will be more difficult because fast chargers are fewer and slower. What's your advice? So, John, are Tesla and other chargers interchangeable? And is there some law saying they're supposed to be?
Well, there's no law that I'm aware of, but Tesla is opening up some of their supercharging stations to other vehicles. You have to use an adapter to go from the Tesla style plug to what you typically see in a level three plug. We're starting to see some of that. I actually went to one, I don't know, sometime over the springtime, and it wasn't available for that. So, but it's supposed to be something that's coming. Most all new vehicles now are starting to adapt the same style Tesla plug, which will help with some of that. So, but you'll be sort of you'll buy a subscription to Tesla charging. It's basically the way it's going to work, from what I heard. Yeah, where I live, I have very limited charging. The nearest mall near me has four sets of charging stations at level three, all different brands, which is actually kind of amazing. And you know, it could be Charge America, it could be Bosch. Shell has a sign in front of one of them. And we are starting to see more of that. We're starting to see 350 kilowatt charging stations, which is pretty fast. Again, it took 100 years to get here for gasoline cars. It's going to take a while to, you know, get completely on board with electric vehicles. And the ideal way to charge an electric vehicle is at home. The more you do high speed charging, the harder it is on the battery. So charging at home on level two, if you can do that, is a lot kinder to the battery. The battery will last a lot longer. We have 36 Ford Lightning pickup trucks at work, and we find the range charging at level two is up about 20% over level three.
And Jamie, I want to toss to you. I also want to say that, you know, we can't talk about Tesla without talking about the recalls that have come out in the last few months. So go.
Well, I just wanted to say to the caller who's, you know, wanted to maybe trade in the Tesla, but was worried about the charging network. That's a valid concern. I've seen bumper stickers that said that say we bought this before we knew Elon was crazy. So if you're worried about that, slapping it on certainly maybe sends the message that changing, you know, that maybe changing a car would as well. But yeah, Tesla has had a recent recall of I think about 1.4 million vehicles, and it's because the hood might open while you're driving, which is kind of funny to think about, unless you're in the car, and it's due to a software update that they need to do. But this just really speaks to the larger, I mean, it's not just Tesla. There are tons of recalls out there. Everyone should take the VIN, which is on the left-hand side, the driver's side of their car. It should be right under the windshield. It'll be printed right there. It's also part of your registration. And go to safercar.gov. Enter the VIN, register there. So when there is a recall, you will be notified. And sometimes it seems like something small, like, oh, it's just the wrong sticker on the door jamb, or oh, it's cruise controls, but I just won't use cruise control. Well, ultimately, like you need to get it taken care of because not getting it fixed can lead to other things. And thinking back, and gosh, this is a long, long time ago, but there was a Ford issue with cruise control, and people were like, I just won't use cruise control. But what happened was the error in the cruise control system could cause the car to catch fire. And so people would not use cruise control, park it in their garage, and then their houses would burn down. So stay on top of your recalls, whether you're driving a Tesla or any other model. But if you're worried about kind of the Tesla charging network and you want to switch out of that brand for various reasons, there are adapters coming in. There are a lot of other good EVs on the market that I think in some cases are a lot better than Teslas. But ultimately, you know, you can hop on Amazon and get a bumper sticker for under $5, and that might solve the problem that you're trying to solve as well.
All right. Well, we're going to go to Paul calling from Portland. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. My name's Paul Drynan. I work for the Bicycle Coalition of Maine. And I'd love to hear from your panel about this trend with certain American vehicles, mostly pickup trucks, just the monstrous size with these gigantic front ends. You know, the CEO of Ford Motor Company was recently quoted as saying, we need to get away from this trend of oversized vehicles and get back to vehicles that are more sensibly sized. And I think the implication there is directly aligned with the data we're seeing. You know, if there's conflict with a vehicle like this, the chances of a fatality versus an injury is much more likely. So I'd love
Sure,
to hear
Paul,
from your
thank you.
panel.
We have so many calls and so little time. I'm going to go to Jamie, back to Jamie on this. Isn't there some psychology too that people are more aggressive when they're in a bigger vehicle? Aren't there some studies?
Yeah, I mean, they feel safer because, frankly, they are safer, but they're just transferring the risk to everyone else on the road. And I think what people forget is that the visibility from these large vehicles, these large trucks, is absolutely terrible. You cannot see, you know, a person who is under 5'6" when they're standing, you know, directly in front of you or even a couple of feet in front of you. You're not going to see a child. You're not going to see a person on a bike. You're going to have massive blind spots. And so if you want to have one of these huge vehicles, I think that's totally fine, but you have to understand that they take a lot more attention and driving skill than something smaller would.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul. Here from Tracy in email. Please talk about the concerns regarding crashes and fires, how it is a new concern to fire departments. My son, a firefighter, helped with the fatal crash in Naples about a month ago. The batteries exploded and it was a huge environmental situation. Over 3,000 tiny cell battery fires took 13 times the water to extinguish compared to a gas-fueled vehicle. John, is that a concern that AAA is looking into? And what's interesting is it seems so counterintuitive. One would think the gas that's, you know, could ignite so easily would be more dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, gasoline cars certainly catch fire more than electric cars do. Electric cars, the batteries can overheat, and that's what causes them to combust. They do something, firefighters now are being taught to smash all the windows and actually fill the car with water, which cools the battery pack off, which prevents kind of spontaneous combustion from happening. Also, there's training how to disconnect the battery packs and all that sort of stuff. You know, is it a bigger problem than gasoline cars? No, it's actually less of a problem because there's less electric vehicles on the road, but you know, they electric cars catch fire, gasoline cars catch fire. It depends on where and when.
All right, we'll go to David calling from Portland. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Great.
And the panel. I wanted to speak to Penelope and Jamie. Penelope, who called regarding her pending car purchase, truck purchase. I'm a sales manager at a dealership in the Portland area, and I want Penelope to know that not all dealerships are cut from the same cloth. Our sales force is 10 people, and one-third of them are women. We have a woman in sales management. We have women working in every facet of our sales department and our entire dealership. So Penelope needs to know that the landscape is not the same all over, and we're not all out there just trying to take advantage.
David, thank you for calling. She was calling from Levant, not in the Portland area. So I'm just wondering, if you were Penelope, what would you do? How would you discover the better dealership?
I think I'm going to go to what Jamie said. Reach out to a dealership. If her comfort level is with another woman, see if the dealership has a woman on the sales team and request to work with that person. I would check Google reviews for dealership personnel and look at the folks that other clients are saying they had a great relationship with, whether it's a man or a woman, and shop for your salesperson the way you shop for the car.
Well, David, I really appreciate you calling in. Thank you so much. Just a couple minutes left. So many good questions. This one from Linda. Given our urgent need to reduce CO2, do you see any significant incentives coming from the government to get more folks to buy electric cars? Many consumers can't afford them. So, Jamie, the tax rebate landscape is changing. Will it change again?
Well, we have an election in November that will probably impact that. But just overall, you know, we have right now tax incentives, I think, of up to $7,500. That depends on the type of car you get, where it was assembled, how much of it, you know, was assembled and built in the United States. So it's very important to remember that it's up to $7,500. And they changed how it works. It used to be that you would have to claim that $7,500, you know, when you did your taxes. Now you can transfer it to the dealer and they apply it to the cost of the deal, to the cost of the vehicle, which brings down the cost, you know, by the amount of the tax incentives that you're getting. There are also, you know, local incentives for installing chargers and things like that. But I think, you know, I'm not seeing any major changes on the horizon, but, you know, there's going to be a new administration in a new Congress in November. So we would just have to keep an eye on that. If that is something that is, you know, important to you, I'd recommend bringing it up to candidates in your area, as well as your local representatives.
All right, let's see here. We have so little time left and so many questions coming in. I want to apologize to everybody whose question we were not able to get to. And I want to ask you, John, with AAA, what is your advice for folks who have questions and did not get onto main calling today?
They can email me. I'd be happy to answer anyone's questions through email, certainly. My email is jpaul@aaanortheast.com. But yeah, you know, the other thing is, you know, look around. There's a lot of good information. There's a lot of bad information out there as well. But you know, if people are car shopping, I think Jamie hit it on the head. Do it all electronically. Use Car Gurus, IC Cars, True Car. AAA has a car buying site. And you get kind of the price up front. You'll be annoyed by salespeople calling you, but that's good. That's okay, because then now all of a sudden you can kind of pit them against each other and get the best price.
Well, thank you both so much. Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief at CarTalk.com, and John Paul, senior manager for public affairs and traffic safety with AAA Northeast. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue, main calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the dilemma of air conditioning. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.